Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Bramal Ramos, and I am one of the hosts on the channel. And I'm here today with Andre Schmid to talk about his new book, North Korea's Mundane Revolution. Welcome to New Books, Andre, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So, you know, we always start at the beginning with a question about beginnings. So how did you come to work on North Korean history?
Well, anytime you ask a historian about origins questions, they can trace it back further and further. So I sort of have my academic reason and then maybe a personal reason. So maybe I'll start first with the older personal reason. And that is because when I was a student in China in the 1980s, I befriended a group of North Korean students. Interestingly enough, I would go out and have drinks with them, usually in one of their rooms. And we tended to avoid talking about politics, right? But one evening at like 3 a.m, when, you know, we had had maybe a little bit too much baijiu, I noticed that on the bookshelf, there was a selected works of Kim Jong-il. This is when his father, Kim Il-sung, was still in power. And so I thought, okay, finally, I've got a chance to find out, you know, politically what they're thinking. So I turned to one of them and I said to him, you know, we don't hear much about Kim Jong-il overseas. What's he like? And even though he had had enormous quantities to drink, he sort of turned to me and he goes, well, you know, Andre, some people say he's even better than his father. And at that time, I just sort of accepted it. But the next morning when I woke up, I was thinking, okay, what did he mean by that? And, you know, it's the classic belief question that we hear about so much. And I think at some level, even though at that point I hadn't studied Korea in any depth, I've been in pursuit of that question to try and understand what he was saying at that particular moment. And I don't answer it in this book, right? That's the way something might drive you, but you don't necessarily find something that's satisfying to you. But as I moved on and started studying Korea more formally as a historian, that question sort of faded into the background a little bit, and I just encountered a bunch of frustrations. So the first frustration, for example, was the first textbook I ever read on Korean history, sort of one of those, the entirety of Korean history, you know, where you start back in the Neolithic period and you come right down to contemporary events. And, you know, North Korea made its appearance in 1945 with the division of the peninsula. But then when the war reached the end in 1953 with an armistice, North Korea just disappeared from this textbook. It was as if, like, after the Civil War in the United States, suddenly the South disappeared from the textbook. And, you know, at the time, I wasn't sophisticated enough to appreciate that it was a book written in part by South Korean historians. And it was just too delicate because of the national security laws for them to write about North Korea. And that frustration just sort of continued as I went on to my graduate teaching, where we didn't learn about North Korea at all. The types of books that were coming on now on North Korea, as good as many of them are, were sort of elite politics, that type of Pyongyang watching approach to history that was very much part of the Cold War, that was very much a part about sort of trying to understand decision making, usually in a country that's being presented as being, you know, an enemy country. And that frustration then also appeared in the classroom. You know, I would have students asking me about North Korea, and I really didn't have an answer. So though as a historian, I was frustrated that we didn't have the type of richer histories, right, that are not sort of great man theories, that are not elite politics and, you know, get at what, you know, anybody who's a social, gender, economic historian understands the motive forces of any country moving, you know, much more broadly than just at the peak levels of political society. And I didn't have any answers for my students, right? And so eventually, especially as you began to see that these modes of understanding North Korean history were driving stories in the media, were often arguably driving decisions being made in Washington, D.C. About North Korea, I sort of felt, just as a historian who wanted to present himself as a historian of 20th century Korea, that I had a certain responsibility to try and find out a little bit, not just critique, but actually to try and offer something. And so this book is a small attempt to try and offer, you know, maybe assuage some of those frustrations I was feeling. So that's sort of frustrations as the motivation in a way.
When you're talking about offerings, something I think you make really clear in the book is, you were touching on it in your answer there, but the something you make very clear is the sort of the intervention in North Korean history that this book is making. So as you were describing there, a lot of the work that exists or existed tended to be about decision making and elite high level politics. And most books, as you lay out in the beginning of your book, focus really on the ascent of Kim Il-sung to absolute power. But that's not the story you're telling in this book here. So could you flesh that out a little bit? What did you think was lacking, and how are you trying to sort of offer something different here?
Yeah, so the story of Kim Il-sung's ascent is an incredibly important one, and it's important that historians have told that story, right? I think the challenge is that that alone cannot explain the trajectory of the country, right? If I could make a comparison to Soviet and Chinese history, if you look at the way Soviet history and Chinese history were counted in the 1960s, you know, the way Mao and Stalin were represented in the 1960s was very similar to the way Kim Il-sung was represented in the 1960s, right? Especially that totalitarian ability to control it. But since the 1960s, our understanding of Stalin, our understanding of Mao have just changed tremendously. Nobody would argue that that was the core of trying to understand the Soviet or Chinese society of any era, right? But in North Korean history, because continued division, I'd argue, you know, that 1960s understanding of Kim Il-sung hasn't changed all that much. And I think what a lot of historians are trying to do now, and I don't want to claim to be the only person. I think there are people in North America, there are people in Europe, and there are a lot of people in South Korea that are trying to sort of just simply broaden our understanding of the motive forces of history in North Korea from the late 40s through down to today. So my particular tact on trying to do that was to initiate a study sort of on domesticity, in a way, was my first idea. And I think, you know, there's a long line of historians of domesticity, you know, working on the social, economic, gendered, cultural history of various societies. And what they've shown really successfully, and this was the attraction to me, successfully shown that, you know, to understand any social order, any political economy, you've got to understand the relations in the household and the relations of that household to broader social forces. And that, of course, makes gender a fundamental part of history. And this just struck me in a way as a sort of a strategy on how to get issues of power, right? We still want to talk about power in North Korea, but not talk about it as just residing at the very top of the country, but like within social, economic, political forces, in neighborhoods and cities, for example, in the families. And ultimately, the hope was, you can tell me better than I can whether I managed to pull this off, but the hope was to try and show that, you know, Kim Il-sung isn't this figure that transcends history somehow and controls everything, but rather he is, you know, it sounds really like a mundane, to use the word in my title, mundane point, but that he is a person who's the product of his era. And it's not that he created the era. And the problem, I think, with too much focus on him, as it stands in many of the histories, is he seems to be, you know, transcendent, sort of the monocausal force. It's almost like the history of the country becomes a biographical study of the single person, right? We've got to move beyond that. Anybody, I think anybody who studies history knows that that's an issue, a problem. The question is then, how do you go about getting alternatives?
Speaking of alternatives, I noticed, I think you say at one point in the book that you start, or at least one version of this book, started out with you trying not to use the name Kim Il-sung in the book. That was, you know, one version of this book exists out there somewhere in that form. I'm curious, was there, I guess this is difficult because I'm sort of asking a question about the book that does not exist, but what made you decide not to take that approach? Or, you know, did the book go through any like similar structural changes like that, of that magnitude? Because that seems like quite a big shift.
Yeah, it was a big shift. I think there was a point where I was writing, you know, I even used to give lectures called is a North Korean history without Kim Il-sung possible, right? With a question mark there. And you know, my position then, as it is still now, is yes, it's absolutely possible, right? It's a complicated country, and there's all sorts of social forces that you don't have to refer to Kim Il-sung. We refer to him way too much. So you can write that history independent of him. And that was my original goal. But I think as time went on and this project took a little bit longer than I expected, I realized a couple of things. One is it was a little bit childish of me. It was, you know, I was sort of reacting against the over-concentration on Kim Il-sung, you know, by, you know, classic thing with the steering wheel driving down the road where I veer to the left when everybody wants to go to the right. I think then I sort of had some friends, some colleagues telling me, well, you know, you should relate it because that's what people want to know. And I listened to that advice, and eventually I realized that that advice had actually a more serious critical component to it, that if I wrote without Kim Il-sung, then this would sort of be a parallel history. As well, we know parallel lines don't intersect, right? And in a way, I wanted to be able to critique those histories or that overemphasis on Kim, as well as to, I couldn't show that Kim was a product of the era if I didn't include him, right? Mm-hmm. So everything from his language to his ideas are so resonant with what's going on in the 1950s that I decided I would do a sort of a concluding chapter. And I try and, you know, I don't want it to be the climax, right? I don't want to be, oh, finally, there's, you know, what do you want to say about Kim Il-sung? I sort of try and present it as a denouement to show that he, you know, is secondary to a lot of the things that I'm trying to talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm. He comes out of and is a product of the history that you've been charting up until that point.
Yeah, I hope that's.
Yeah, I desperately want to ask about sources, because I suppose in your sort of your quest to, you know, write a history that was not about Kim Il-sung and write a different kind of history, one that emphasized, you know, explorations of social history, the mundane, gender, that all, you know, is only possible if you have the sources to tell those stories. And you have a wonderful appendix in this book that tells the story of how you found some of the sources that you use. And I'll just note, it gives, you know, readers a sense of how they too might find some of those sources. So I'd love it as an artifact at the end of your book. So could you talk a little bit about that? How did you find the sources in this book? And what was surprising to you about that journey?
Right. Well, I guess one of the reasons I hesitated to dive into North Korean history was because I wasn't really sure what type of sources were available. When I looked at much of the stuff that has been written, again, it focused on that high level politics, you know, much of that stuff, especially now, has been written very productively in many cases from Soviet and Eastern European archives. So sort of those are the type of secret documents exchanged between communist parties and ambassadors and the like. And those have increasingly been available even in English through various translation projects. And there's some great work done on that. The question then became, if you wanted to do something that was dealing with social history, with economic history, where could you go? And I think I had to go through a process of unlearning because I didn't realize that those types of sources were actually readily available, right? I just thought, you know, you'd have to do this type of Indiana Jones-like type of hunting of sources, which wasn't the case at all. It was just my imagination wasn't powerful enough to think where they might be. And I think the first time, I think I tell a story in that appendix of being on the Harvard Library website when I realized they had a, it was one of the first times I'd seen place of publication on a search engine. I put in Pyongyang, 1953 to 1965, and I was shocked to see like 700 titles come out of the search. Then I did something that was very telling, I think, of the way I was still thinking of North Korea, as I arranged it by author, to assuming that most of those titles would be Kim Il-sung books. And you know, I ended up, there were less than 10 that were Kim Il-sung, so I ended up spending the rest of the night sort of reading these titles, and they just didn't jive with what I understood North Korean to be about. There was clearly a much richer publishing history than I had imagined. And again, this is, you know, maybe my own issues with imagining North Korea at that point in my life. Other people knew better, but I ended up getting on the plane a couple of weeks after that and going down to Boston and just starting to read materials. And then so what I began to realize is that the type of materials that were published in Pyongyang that North Koreans were reading every day, as much as they're controlled by the party, sanctioned by the party, and have all sorts of limits on them, still opened up a very different world for understanding North Korea. And, you know, when I was reading this stuff, all these light bulbs were going off, and I really just like, I didn't know that. I didn't know that, right? And so I started on this search of trying to unlearn a little bit more definitively by going to other libraries. So I eventually ended up going to Moscow, which again, you know, silly me, I should have thought that, of course, Moscow has a lot of North Korean materials because it's like the repository for the socialist world, and North Korea was sending all sorts of stuff there. And again, it's in like a reader-friendly library. And then the third place, you know, again, I should have known. And I'd heard a little bit more about this. I just didn't appreciate it fully, is in at the Library of Congress in Washington, right? Because the CIA had been purchasing through three third-party countries all sorts of materials on North Korea, and they had released them to the library. Many of them still aren't cataloged, but now a lot of them are even digitalized, so you can read them in your living room. So this idea that somehow North Korean history is difficult to do because there are no sources, right? I think sometimes we historians like to play up the sort of adventure of finding sources, right? But North Korea is not distant, right? When I can read these journals in my living room now off my hard drive, it's, you know, very accessible. And I think it's partly this shift. I'm not the only person looking at this, right? I mentioned earlier, there's lots of communities of scholars starting to look at this type of work, and we're just asking different questions. So it's a different type of source. It's different types of questions. They're not focused on elite politics so much. And so we're getting a much more diversified history of North Korea.
I think you describe when you're talking about the different libraries and the appendix, you talk about how, you know, the sources are in some of the most user-friendly libraries in the world, which I love as a phrase and thinking about. Not only are these, you know, prominent institutions, but they're very easy to access.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's, I don't want to say that this is the answer to every question we might have about North Korea, right? There are still publicly published, party sanctioned types of publications. So, you know, if I can continue with the Soviet and Chinese comparisons, right? We don't have anything like what's going on in the China field, right? Or in the Soviet field, the opening up of actual archives. So when you think of the works that are coming on the Stalinist period, or the stuff I hear from all my colleagues about all the, well, a few years ago anyway, all my Chinese history colleagues going and finding stuff at antique markets and flea fairs and things like that, right? We don't have those types of materials. So there's still, you know, some very real limits. You have to be careful about the representational politics and strategies of the party, and they're constantly trying to read against the grain. But we can do so much more with those and get at certain types of historical questions, not always with completely satisfying answers, but we can do a lot more, I think, than we were doing 20 years ago, certainly. And you can see that in the types of publications that are coming out.
So you were talking there about, you know, being very careful about the material, about how you use the material that you have access to. And, you know, I think you also make in the point, you make the point in the book that, you know, the writers of the articles and the magazines and journals that you're using were creators of and subjected to the sort of discourse of the time. And you make the point that that discourse was, you know, there was a bit of push and pull there. They were contributing to that discourse as much as they were being, you know, told. It wasn't so much top down. I mean, I think that comes through most clearly in these flashes of criticism that you have sort of throughout the book, at least in every section, where you introduce a particular source. And this is about, you know, reading against the grain and reading very carefully each of the sources that you introduce. It offers a different idea, a different interpretation, and sort of raises different tensions. And some of them are small. You're talking about, you know, some of the limits you don't maybe quite have. You know, some of the passionate denouncements of that exist in other periods, but they're subtle, they're small, but they're definitely there. So in thinking about those moments, was there a particular reason you decided to include them as you do throughout the book? And is there one in particular that you think sort of captures what you're trying to do with these flashes of criticism?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I wanted to sort of include some of these flashes of criticisms is because as historians, we tend to want to tell a smooth, complete narrative, right? We move from A to Z in a straight line. And as much as we know we're deploying all sorts of rhetorical devices to make that narrative smooth, I feel a certain discomfort with that smoothness sometimes, especially when you're reading a body of sources and you realize that there's stuff that just doesn't fit, you know? So what do you do with the stuff that doesn't fit? It's not that it runs against your argument per se, but there are these weird things out there that you read. And so what do you do with weird things as a historian that don't fit? That took on a special urgency because in North Korea, of course, the party always talks about ideology as being harmonious, monolithic. There's this expression for Kim Il-sung's thought, it's the Yuil Sasang, right? The singular and unifying thought of the country. And, you know, there's this desire, there's almost a bizarre pleasure amongst many foreign critics in the media about North Korea, about speaking about that unity, right? And overemphasizing that unity even more than it's emphasized inside the country. And so these flashes of criticisms gave me an opportunity to show one more way that things weren't just monolithic. And some of these also spoke to North Korea's position in the world, its relationships with its allies. So one of them that I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's one that I think is powerful, is the reprinting of Mao's famous speech from 1957 that launched the 100 Flowers Bloom campaign. And, you know, I think I chose that example partly because it shows also a big difference between what's going on in the PRC and the DPRK at this particular moment. All the contradictions, right? So the speech is titled on the correct handling of contradictions amongst the people. All the contradictions that Mao is talking about are incredibly serious self-critiques of the way China has been going, right? About post-revolutionary change. That's a type of critique that just doesn't exist in North Korea, right? You do not have Kim Il-sung talking about class formation, new class formations after the revolution or after the establishment of the country in 1948. You don't have him talking about contradictions between the leadership and the people or amongst the people, right? And so the question then becomes, well, where did this come from? And you can make an argument, I don't make it in the book, that it's connected to some of the factional fighting at the time. But I think what's interesting about many of these flashes of criticisms is that they point to people in North Korea that are hinting at the directions that the revolution should have gone and didn't, right? So rather than being, you know, what often people are looking for sort of a democratic or liberal alternative critiques of the regime, which you never find, right? What you do find, ironically, are more radical critiques that it's not socialist enough, it's not pure enough. And you can find this on issues of politics. You can find it, I think, on issues of gender as well. So I appended to each part of the book one of these flashes of criticisms to try and capture a little bit of that sensibility of the disjointedness of discourse at that period, that it's not all smooth and that my story itself isn't smooth.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you find, and that you find a lot in your book, are, of course, visual materials. And I have to mention the cartoons, because in thinking of criticisms and critique and sort of, the idea that it's not going far enough, that there are some issues, and a lot of that seems to be, at least to me, being played out in on the visual realm. And there's a ton of comics and cartoons, yeah, in your book, that as a reader was just really interesting to see, because that's not something, I mean, I would have particularly expected. Was that a surprise to you as you were looking through these magazines, that there was so much, you know, sort of rich visually going on?
Yeah, I didn't expect that at all, like you. And that so many of them were really funny. Like, I find myself in the library laughing. So I wanted to incorporate them also, just to push myself a little bit as a historian, to do a different type of history where I used images not just as sort of examples of something that I was arguing anyway, sort of eye candy, but actually to move the narrative I was telling at times. And I think when I get to consumption, maybe the images are more important for the narrative itself. But yeah, I would say that some of those comics, and, you know, there are people who specialize on the use of humor in authoritarian regimes and how humor becomes sort of a double-sided type of humor. You can see how, or you can guess, that these cartoonists are sort of playing a double game, right? So if I could give one other example, maybe to bring up the gender question, there's this one classic example in the North Korean women's magazine of sort of a two-paneled comic, where in the first panel labeled in the past, there's a woman at home and she's on her knees scrubbing the floor clean while her husband is sitting on a chair smoking and not paying any attention to her. And then there's a second panel that says today, and the husband has joined her on the floor and is scrubbing clean the floor with her. And, you know, you could look at that, and that's clearly the gender ideology of a happy, equal couple cooperating with the domestic chores, right? And so, you know, some people may have looked at that and said, oh, yeah, you know, that's the ideology of the moment, and this comic is promoting it. On the other hand, if you put it in the context of its location in that particular women's journal, that was always, you could always read between the lines that it was pretty frustrated with some of the ways domestic work was being discussed or not being discussed, that it was in a position where there are frequently satirical comics, then you begin to realize that probably many of the women readers of that magazine would look at that comic and they would laugh at the idea that their husband would get on the floor with them and scrub it clean, right? So you could see that readers might react in both ways. I would guess more the latter way, frankly. And I would guess that that was one of the cartoonist's intentions. But I think it's a good example of how with these types of sources, when you're reading through the lines, you don't really know which way people would lean, right? And it lends itself to more than one interpretation.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of happy family, and this goes with sort of visual material, and I'm alluding not very subtly here to the cover of the book, but also the photograph, that particular photograph that features on the cover of your book that comes up, I think, at the beginning of your book and at the end of your book. If I can describe it, it shows a family of four, mother, father, and two children, dressed very, very nicely, looking out over a newly constructed neighborhood. And you describe this photograph in the book as being sort of instantly recognizable to readers, representing an ideal vision of what was widely touted as the new living. And this is something that comes up again and again in your book. So, you know, for listeners who might not have read your book, what is new living and sort of what do we need to know about it as we dive a little bit deeper into your book itself?
Yeah, the term new living does a lot of work in my book, and it does a lot of work partly because the concept itself is somewhat vague, right? And I don't want to deny the vagueness. I want to employ the vagueness of it. So rather than giving it a strict definition that would sort of corner it, I think the vagueness is an important part of it. As a historian, the new living for me was a useful way to getting at these questions of domesticity. So it overlaps pretty neatly with the historiographical trends and directions that I mentioned earlier. But it also does some other stuff at that time. New living, of course, is a term that is not monopolized by North Korea. It's a term that has a long history in East Asia more broadly, right? It existed in the Republican period in China, right? Chiang Kai-shek had that new life movement, same expression. We know it was in Japan as well. Contemporaneously to my use of it in North Korea, or its use in North Korea, it's not my term, right? It was being used in South Korea less frequently, but it was also present there, which I think speaks to that history. So on the one hand, you know, there's the irony of that word new, which appeals to the party because it implies revolution, right? But of course, the irony is that it's not actually so new, and it has continuity with the past. And it's through terms like this that various types of practices sort of jump that 1945 divide, jump from the colonial period into the North Korean period. And so it also allows me to not just look at issues of domesticity and the mundane, but show that North Korea is not starting from a blank slate, that I can return it to the flow of 20th century Korean history, if not the flow of 20th century East Asian history, to show how these issues continue to run through. And it's also a term that is never really particularly critiqued by the party, right? Kim Il-sung never has a speech about the new life, right? It's just one of these terms that you find everywhere. There's a magazine named on it. It's in the texts of the period all over the place. And so it's not a term that is specifically socialist, yet it is harnessed to a vision of what type of socialist practices the party is believing and many elites are believing should be practiced by ordinary people as well. So it's this neat little nexus to look at a bunch of historical and historiographical issues that are shaping social, economic, and cultural life in North Korea in the 50s and 60s.
And in many ways, it seems to be something of like a quest here, and it's never defined, it's never pinned down, and so it can as a concept be continually, moved towards, and it can be continually reimagined as again new, each one new, each one sort of reinterpreted in slightly different ways or dramatically different ways, but it's always that quest, that striving that seems to be the focus of the concept itself.
Absolutely. It's always linked with some idea of reform, right? Of the need for change and the need of something better. It's only if we establish the parameters of a new living that we're going to be able to achieve the abundance of modernity, right, that everybody is pursuing. So it's definitely linked to that idea of a social, political, and economic goal for the broader population through self-reform at some level.
Yeah, I was going to mention the self part because the focus on the individual that you sort of tease out in the book, as someone who's more familiar with sort of reform and this kind of socialist transformation in the context of China, the focus on the individual to me is wild. In terms of it's just very specific and quite a bit different. But this focus on the individual you talk about, throughout your book, but in particular, in the first section where you're talking about this question that everyone is sort of being asked to think about, which is how do you self-improve? How do you become a good socialist? How do you better yourself, you, the self? And so you look at quite a lot of advice literature in this part of your book, which has lots of ideas on how you can work on yourself continually. So could you talk a little bit about this? What were some of the ways that, the self, the individual was supposed to be, working on the self?
Yeah, so again, this was one of those things that surprised me a little bit when I first came across some of the etiquette manuals in the libraries. Maybe not so surprisingly, but it matched on historiographically to some of the work that's been done in the Soviet period, especially in the Stalinist period, where historians have focused very much on sort of the rise of the socialist individual subject, matches neatly with some of the issues that Foucault talks about. So there was sort of a bunch of things coming together in these etiquette manuals that, on the one hand, are very socialist in the sense that they talk about the need to develop one's collective consciousness, socialist ideals of labor, for example. But then there's all these other things that are going on that, again, as I mentioned when I spoke about New Life, have this longer history. And these are just simply etiquettes in terms etiquette practices in terms of like civility, right? Let's learn how to shake hands properly. Let's line up for the bus properly. Let's like not sit in other people's seats in the theater. Clearly, some of this is motivated by a longer history of urbanization, right? The early period of North Korea is a rapid period of urbanization, and there's clearly sort of people in the city that are a little bit worried about the country bumpkins coming into town, many of the party members, and wanting them to behave properly, right? And this gets folded into the idea of a socialist subject. Language becomes incredibly important, how to speak. This is an especially sensitive area after the banning of Korean in the last years of the colonial period, so that, the resurrection of Korean as the national language, as the public language, is something that is arising in this period. But how to speak it properly becomes an issue right after it's been suppressed and after scholars haven't been able to study it, haven't been able to write grammar books, haven't been able to write dictionaries for decades. And we can see that that's going on in South Korea as well. In North Korea, of course, you have the issue of language coming together with how to learn the proper socialist terms, since in the colonial period, socialism had also been suppressed. And so you get a lot of introduction of, how to speak properly in terms of what economic terms to use, for example. There's major didactic effort. And then maybe the third area that I wasn't expecting to see at all is that there's this very gendered effort to get women to speak in a very feminine way, right? And you know, authors who are writing in text have difficulty describing what it is, and it's these types of adjectives that we're all familiar with, you know, speak modestly, speak indirectly, speak with humility, these types of terms. And you can see that language is being reinvented in a time when there's momentous change in gender relations as well. And so, you know, never before have there been as many women in absolute numbers entering factories or entering wage work. And so language, I think, becomes one of the ways that, as important as it is for this sort of post-colonial resurrection of Korean language, is also serving the furthering of the socialist project, but also the containment, in a sense, of some of the social effects of all these women entering a new array of wage work for the first time in Korean history. So all these things are about self-reform and you know, making yourself a better, more ideologically better, culturally better subject.
Mm-hmm. And part of that, especially, you know, for those women who are entering the workforce, part of that seems to be about sort of self-reliance and sort of, you know, taking initiative. So you talk a little bit in this chapter about, you know, certain stories, I think had to do with a sort of a dormitory and the showers are broken. And the problem is not the faulty facilities. The problem is that the residents did not fix the problem. Right. So there's this whole sort of redirection. And we'll see this a little bit later with regards to women entering the workforce. If women entering the workforce, they have a problem with childcare, the problem is that they have not sorted that issue out. that's where the real issue is. It's with the non-self-reliant, you know, individual socialist self, that's really the what needs fixing in this new way of thinking of the individual.
Absolutely. And I guess what's going on in this period is the party has, by 1958, it claims that it has completely collectivized the economy. So whatever private merchants had been allowed to exist now are brought back into the public distribution system. There are no, in the party's eyes, again, no remaining classes that haven't been, in theory, brought back into the national collective in the cities anyway. And so what it means for people that are writing is it becomes very difficult to criticize anything structural, because as a collectivized economy, then there shouldn't be any structural problems. Right. And so by speaking about structural problems, you're in a sense then criticizing the party, however indirectly, and its claims and self-assessments of the state of the revolution. Right. So the party then moves to saying that the reason we haven't achieved a completely socialized country, despite the collectivization of the material means of the economy, is because of the ideological levels of our population. And they can explain it because of the war, because of colonialism. People haven't had the time to self-reform, elevate their levels of ideology, and that's what's holding us back. And so with that assumption, right, the focus turns to how are people catching up? How are they self-reforming? Improving. And so all of these types of issues that we've been talking about have this grander theory on the part of the party, which eventually, you know, blames the individual. If in effect, it sort of gives the party a bit of an out, if you would, but it also limits the style of critiques that people have to dance around this type of issue. And many do, right? They dance around it. But yeah, you know, those are sensitive issues.
There shouldn't also, you know, in this model, there shouldn't also be any gender problems, right? That's sort of part of this whole, almost want to say mythos, but that's part of this whole idea that all the problems have been solved, so there are no longer gender issues. And you talk in the book about how New Living, the idea is that it's sort of depoliticized both gender and class, and this is something that comes up again and again. And we've touched on it a little bit with some of the problems that then women were, in charge of, dealing with on the individual level as they entered the workplace. And this is something you talk about in the book with regards to childcare in particular, and also, the managing of the house. So this gets us a little bit further into your book where you talk about some of the answers that were proposed to, questions about how to build more efficiently, but also how to have a happy family home. And there seems to have been quite a lot of women, housewives in particular, that were, being given advice on how they could fix their home, fix their work, fix their marriage. And in general, they were being told to step up, find employment. There are no gender problems, gender-related problems here. So there's a lot going on, both sort of, ideologically and also just in terms of the really, rich material that you've got to work with. And lots of it seems unhappy housewives. But is there something in particular that stands out to you as being, particularly emblematic of the depoliticization of gender, specifically in this period?
Yeah, so we want to maybe I point out first of all that in 1946, in the first year of the regime, there were all these important gender laws passed. So it's quite historic, right? In the history of not just North Korea, not just Korea, but Asia, I think these might be the very first gender equality laws promulgated, right? It's before it happens in China, it's before it happens in Vietnam or Japan. And the interesting thing is that as much as those gender laws are regularly celebrated by the party, look, in the sense in that sort of savior complex, look what we've done, this great accomplishment, it then becomes very difficult for women to actually appeal to those laws as a way of affecting a critique of any current practice or socioeconomic condition, right? So you can't go and say, look, we've got this law, but look what's actually happening. There's a gap between the two, and we got to do something about it, right? And they're unable to do that in this authoritarian environment because that those gender laws are seen as having been sort of they're a badge of achievement on the part of the party that it's constantly boasting about, and to suggest that it didn't live up to them just in the political culture of the moment is something that isn't possible for the Women's Federation, despite the various ways within the pages of its journal that you can see people trying to articulate various types of more specific critiques that don't target the party or don't get them into trouble, right? So this is part of the general atmosphere of the depoliticization of gender. It's difficult to speak about gender as a structural or systematic problem in Korea in this particular moment. On the other hand, what I found fascinating, and you alluded to this a little bit in your question, is that regularly in this period, you have officials turning to women in a sense, assigning them the task of making up for greater national problems, problems of the economic plan, bottlenecks in production. So that the responsibility for so much stuff actually falls on the shoulders of women without really giving them the credit for it, right? And it's partly, ironically, it's because of these gender laws that then the officials can't say, oh, look how marvelous the actions are of the women in this neighborhood and making up for this problem, because that would admit the problem in the first place, right? So in areas as diverse as childcare, light industrial production, you've got local officials turning to women's security issues, even in the neighborhood, and spy anti-spying campaigns. You get local officials basically turning to women in neighborhoods to basically fulfill the tasks that that official should be doing, right? So whether it be because the government doesn't want to spend money on daycare because there's a cash shortage, basically, eventually it falls on women to organize daycare, even though those national laws speak about the provision of daycare as a way of enabling women to participate in daily wage labor, right? You have household factories being created, right, to try and both get more women involved in wage work, but really because the party has invested so much in heavy industry that they've got a real problem producing consumer goods. And so one of the ways they try and solve that bottleneck in the economy is turning to, again, the women in like single apartment buildings or in a neighborhood to get them to meet, every day for a few hours of the day and get together to sew together underwear and socks and things like this. And there's actually quite a bit of production produced that way. We don't have great statistics on it. And it's also clearly an ideological move on the part of local officials. But again, they have to turn to the labor of women to solve problems they otherwise can't solve.
And it seems to be some, I guess I remember it often enough that I'll say it seems to be often framed in the way of, if you woman, housewife, are unhappy with your lot in life, this will also solve your own personal problems, right? Like your dissatisfaction with your husband, for example, this will be solved by your engaging in work and wage labor and creating those things and making those things. And if you're finding it hard to manage your life, you just have to organize it well, and then you will be happy. This will solve your problems.
The only way to happiness is wage labor, right? Classic in this period, right? So there's no genuine way of legitimizing openly and publicly not participating in wage labor in this period, right? It's not a legitimate choice.
I think you talk, I think it's in the next part of your book, you have a there's you talk about sort of home decor and how people are being told to style their homes. And there's an interview, if I'm remembering correctly, with a woman who has styled her home particularly well. It's particularly beautiful. And that sort of ends with the interviewer, rhetorically asking, how is this possible, reader, that this woman has managed to achieve this level of sort of sophistication? Sure, she doesn't engage in wage labor, but that's not the reason. That's not why she is able to achieve this high level of sophistication and almost glamour, but very minimalist style of glamour. It's not that. You might think that might be your first thought, but it's definitely not, because wage labor is good for us all. So that's not her secret. Her secret is how she has managed to organize everything. So setting aside the fact that she's not engaging in work, in that wage labor, she's not engaging in that, but that's not the reason she is able to be successful.
Yes. And so that story, which is right near the end of the book, is one way I try and show how the Women's Federation is pushing back at some of the party expectations, goals, and promises. So I just a moment ago said that choosing not to participate in labor is not a choice. By 1964, when this particular story comes out, you can see that that article comes about as close as you can to say, okay, this woman is not participating in wage labor, but she's doing something good, right? And she's doing something good through her, here we're appealing to global ideas of efficient management of the household, right? The good mother, the wise housewife. She's a master of those skills, which is considered, the Women's Federation is building those skills as a part of it. Formerly, it was all about managing domesticity together with wage labor. And by 1964, they're managing to sort of separate that a little bit in a way that it'd be hard to think that economic planners would be very happy with articles like that, right? Or even the party itself. But this is part of the dynamic as the society is diversifying, as it is becoming more wealthy by the 1960s, and there's more going on than what the party at its highest levels is understanding or making decisions about.
So we're very firmly now in sort of the final part of your book, which is all about consumption. And we've been sort of talking around that, and you've mentioned, the production of goods, of textiles, that type that type of thing. And as you describe in the book, you say, quote, no question revealed the tensions besetting the political economy and official ideologies more than how men and women should consume, end quote here. Because you touch on this tension about how people were being told daily necessities were being produced, but people couldn't actually buy them. And my favorite example is you have an advertisement for a sewing machine, which looks amazing, but there's no information about price and there's no information about where you can buy it. So you can see it, but you can't actually consume it. And you talk about the sort of same tension in these images of how people should style their houses, their new apartments. Here's how you should style it. You can't actually access any of the things you're seeing, but it's sort of this fantasy. Especially during the sort of the as we move into the 60s. So is there something in particular about consumption that you want to emphasize here as we move towards the later part of the 60s and the later part of your book?
So I guess what I'd like to emphasize about consumption is not just the question of shortages, right? That's something we hear about a lot of socialist countries. It's actually how those shortages are configured in the media and what they mean about stratification or class changes in North Korean society. So a moment ago, we were talking about how Kim Il-sung, unlike Mao and the party in general, did not speak about the class formations or any type of stratification once it had come into power. But when you look at the direction the consumer industries have gone by 1960s, you know, it's one of the areas that even though we don't have empirical data about changes in class or stratification of various types, you can begin to see that there are substantive differences, right? Especially in the way consumption is spoken about culturally. So interior decor is a great example of that. And so I turned to interior decor in part because there's this massive building boom after the destruction of the Korean War. There are all these apartment buildings that are being created. And, you know, in some ways it's a revolutionary change just in terms of lifestyle that everybody now is getting these prefab apartments, or at least in the cities, you know, we don't know exactly, but a good portion of the population is getting access to the new style of architectural form. So the question becomes, you know, how do you decorate them? And as light industries are improving, as people's incomes are improving, the question becomes, what are the differences between those income levels, right? The party instrumentalizes income differences as a way of providing incentives for workers. Right. So if you're a good worker in a good industry, you're going to make a lot more money than a worker who isn't so efficient in a not ideal industry. Those differences are spoken up openly, right? Socialism is not about the equality of wages, right? According to the party, they talk about that all the time. And so what does this mean in terms of access to goods? We don't know exactly. But when you have stories about decorating your home and how to decorate it, and you're reading somebody speaking about, you know, you need a different type of vase for each season, but then you look in the same, in a different newspaper, sometimes the same newspaper, you see that the Pyongyang porcelain factory is having difficulties with its production, so there aren't enough vases, right? So you can begin to see that there's these sort of bottlenecks, problems in the way decor advocates are writing as if consumption isn't even a problem. And then you read economic stuff and you realize there's a lot of challenges. Now, that might not surprise us, but what we can see is that then what that means is that many of the discussions in the magazines about home decor are, you know, like when I read Architectural Digest, I can, you know, dream about having a home like an Architectural Digest, but I'm certainly never going to be able to create such a home for myself. So there's a certain, you know, that's a bit of an outrageous comparison, but there is this idea that they're consuming the images, they're consuming discourse. It's aspirational. It's still talking about the future. And, you know, there's because there's been so much change since 1953, there's been substantial improvement. You know, it's not completely far-fetched for good sections of the department that are not like that family on the cover standing on its balcony, right, who don't have that type of material comfort, that they might just be thinking that this will be possible if they can get things right. By 1965, I think that sort of mass utopia dream for many people is still alive. Some people have reached it, other people are aspiring for it. So we don't have the data to understand, right? And this is the limit of the types of sources that we talked about earlier. We don't know exactly. Yet you can see these tensions in the discourse of the era, in the publications, that are reflecting deeper challenges in the political economy, even though our information about them is somewhat anecdotal and is looking at what are political and economic challenges through the cultural discourse that is producing and affirming those contradictions.
Mm-hmm. It's all part of that quest. You too, maybe, will one day be able to, you know, find your way to acquiring the seasonally appropriate vases in which you will place your single flower. That quest,
like
you
that
might
little flower.
Yeah, just one, not a, just has to be tasteful.
Not too many.
I read the advice. It was very specific. One flower, just the one.
So do you only have one flower on your desk then, after reading that advice?
I'll be honest, it made me think quite a little bit about my attachment to clutter. But setting that aside, we've come to what you were describing right at the beginning of our conversation, what you hoped would not be the climax of your book, the denouement of the book, the last section, the conclusion, where you look at the rise of Kim Il-sung. And I should note here, you have a really interesting example that you give about Kim Il-sung's relationship to prefab apartments and ceiling heights in particular, which I found fascinating about his thoughts on ceiling heights. I'll just leave that there for listeners as a teaser for that. But zooming out, the rise of Kim Il-sung, is there anything in particular you want to highlight about the connection between New Living and his rise as we come to the denouement of your book?
Sure. So this is the period where we know there was all sorts of factional fighting in the party as he's trying to gain unilateral control over what are the institutions of the state. And while those are clearly hardcore politics, people die, people are exiled, people run away because of them, those rivalries are also integrated with issues that are arising out of the attempt to try and improve people's socioeconomic lives. So I spend quite a bit of time in the book speaking about apartment buildings and the political economy of apartment buildings, the movements to try and increase more buildings, and how this gets entangled in the leadership battles at the top. So I don't want to completely separate those, right? They're important. Those fights are ideological. Those ideological fights have very material consequences. They change work styles in factories around the country. So we have to see Kim Il-sung as being engaged in that type of New Living type of quest, right? He sees himself as being he wants to present himself as being the savior. He wants to present himself as being the provider. Yet at the same time, given all the problems there are in the economy at this time, you know, he risks that the problems get blamed on him. Right. And so there's this delicate dance. He at once is immersed in these things. So he shows up at construction sites, right, claiming to be the person who's leading all this construction. You know, he's not, but he wants to present himself as the sort of head of this developmental project, this historical project. But then when there are problems, right, do they fall his shoulders. No, they don't, right? Because he has all sorts of ways of then not speaking about the monolithic state, the unitary state. He can blame factories. He can blame local governments. So suddenly the unity of the state is broken down in order to try and absolve himself of responsibility for problems. He can blame the ideological levels of the population. But my guess is that that was still sort of a bit of a problem. They realized the precarity or the weakness of that strategy of extricating himself from those mundane problems of socioeconomic living. And this is where the personality cult begins to kick in, of course, because once he wins those factional fights, he begins turning away from just the institutional power of the state leader and begins the types of practices where he sees himself, or he tries to present himself as having a personal relationship with every individual in the country, that relationship isn't really about socialism. It's not about the mundane. It's more an emotional one. It's more one of personal promise, in a sense. And so I don't deal with this in most of the book, because I feel that move to the personality cult is, in a sense, an escape, a move to try and find him outside of the mundane problems of socioeconomic living of the population and their domestic type of challenges, right? But that's an important move in the formation of the personality cult, which in many ways is, and I think, you know, I don't quite say this in the book, but it's in effect, it's a betrayal of the goals of revolutionary socialism that so many people had been struggling with, that the whole book is about. And then he basically vacates that issue of a mass utopia achieved through self-reform and hard work by presenting him in this special light.
Hmm. So we've come to the end of your book and the end of our conversation about your book. So now that you are finished with this book, what are you working on now? What questions, what problems, what beliefs are inspiring you at the moment?
So I think in the long run, I'm not a North Korean specialist, so I'll be moving away from North Korea. But in the short term, given some of the challenges that we talked about historiographically and in sort of popular imagination about North Korea, I want to write something, a shorter book that's a more popular oriented book on North Korea. So I'm actually choosing a single year. I'm going to write one of these histories of a single year, you know, a year in the life of North Korea, where I can broaden the array of subjects that I deal with, where I can look at this particular year for some of the ways it foreshadows what's to come, particularly what's to come in terms of the type of geopolitical issues that the nukes issues, the human rights issues that are in the news all the day, but try and look at them a little bit more historically to give them a little bit more context, since I feel that those issues are discussed today without any understanding of history, precisely because of this type of focus on the very top that we always have.
Mm-hmm. Well, best of luck with that, a year in the life. I look forward to reading it when it comes out. But for now, thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this book.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, for the questions. It's been a real delight. You know, I'm a big fan of the show. I'm always listening to it when I'm on long drives up in northern Canada. So I was really happy to have the chance to talk with you and contribute a little bit.